Now, Pietism and Evangelism had nothing directly to do with the Enlightenment. They were not, as many people thought, a reaction to the Enlightenment, though they became that in a way later. They were not really a reaction to it, but rather Pietism and Evangelism were a religious revival, a reaction against the way in which Lutheranism and Anglicanism had developed over the last two centuries. From having themselves been heresies, they had become establishment religions, and not only had they become establishment religions, but they had certainly by the 17th century become fossilized, institutionalized, dogmatized. Even Luther's mistakes, his spelling mistakes, had become dogma of the German Lutheran Church, enshrined in the Lutheran Catechism. So that it was something very well known in the history of religion, that something which started in a way as a revolt began in the end to be a dogma. Indeed, Catholicism already had a renaissance in the 17th century, which I've mentioned once before. Saint Vincent de Paul, for example, a renaissance of the 17th century, centered upon charity, inwardness, lack of dogma, a kind of mysticism, if you like. So that the Catholic Renaissance will not be so dissimilar from the Protestant Renaissance of the 18th century, it precedes it. The religious revival of Protestantism in the 18th century is sometimes called the Second Reformation. It is based, of course, very largely on a popular piety, which never really changed very much in Europe from the Middle Ages to modern times. A popular piety that was always mystical, if you like, involved in magic to a certain extent, as you will see, but above all involved in a personalization of religion, God, the devil, and Christ, as a kind of attempt to cope with the present and future. And as Lutheranism and Anglicanism not only got more and more fossilized, dogmatized, but became more and more of state churches, became more and more controlled by the church, state churches, they lost more and more contact with popular piety. They lost more and more the kind of function of religiosity, of giving hope, of enabling people to cope with the dangers of daily life. Much the same development underlay the Protestant Reformation in the first place. The Catholic Church had lost contact with much of the daily religious life of the people. And now by the 18th century, both Anglicanism and Lutheranism had lost much of the contact with this kind of daily life through their dogma, through their fossilization, and through their being a state church. For popular piety, in any case, ran a quite a different way than this. In popular piety, as it were, dogma and theology were always badly understood. The Trinity was hardly a popular dogma. But instead, in popular piety, as it were, God was important, Christ was important, as symbol, as personalization. And Pietism will repeat that. Pietism will personalize God again. But the preaching from the pulpit in Anglicanism and in Lutheranism until the 18th century was singularly abstract, dogmatic, when popular piety was engaged in this kind of personalization. The fear of God's wrath, God, a personal God, not a hidden God, God there, always there, and not only God, but the devil. The church long ago had to compromise with the belief in the devil. The devil is a very personal thing. The devil people actually saw looking into their windows. The devil people actually saw coming down, if you like, the chimney place. God, the devil, were personalized always in popular religion. And Christ was personalized through the Mass. He became flesh and blood, not abstract, but personal. The most popular books of popular piety were not books of theology, but books of prophecy, Nostradamus, books which prophesied the future, which people wanted to know, prophesied the future because of the wondrous events of the present. The wonder-working providence, the wonder-working providence of the Puritans was still a wonder-working providence of pietism and of evangelism. What meant something to people, whether Protestant or Catholic, was the local saint, who Protestantism never really managed to abolish. The saint who appeared in one of the local sacred trees. And among villagers, there was competition. Which saint had performed more miracles? The saint of Baraboo or the saint of Portage? In other words, real competitions between them. This was the popular piety, not some theology, the Trinity, not some idea of this nature. This can again be seen by the immense increase, even in the 18th century, of pilgrimages to sacred places, and not only to sacred places, sometimes to the sacred tree where the local saint had made his appearance. All of these kind of things are very important. And indeed, Lutherans, Catholics, Anglicans, they all thundered against the increase in pilgrimages, which of course was a sign of popular piety, which always threatened to escape, in fact, always escaped the control of the church, which always escaped, in fact, the control of the church. Now, all of this was not only, in a way, criticized by the Enlightenment, but by the official church, the state church, Lutheran or Anglican. The many, if you like, the many talismans, the many things people hung around their neck, the use of sacred water to cure holy water, to cure animal diseases. For every natural catastrophe, there was a remedy, and these remedies weren't medical remedies. These remedies were remedies of a religious nature, a part of a saint, sometimes even saints' bones ground up and taken by mouth. In other words, the saints, the amulets, all of this became of the greatest importance. The devil means against the devil. And indeed, you have the miracle books continuing until the 19th century in Protestant and Catholic regions. Miracle books are chroniclers of the local village of the miracle performed by the local saint. Miracle of healing, of curing, of an agricultural sort, if you like, of a good harvest, of providing bread, or of whatever. The point of all of this are really two. First of all, the popular piety, still more active, still more relevant in an age of change, of bewildering change, of greater mobility, when people could leave their native village, when people were disoriented, as it were, by greater mobility and greater change. And secondly, by something that was always present, especially in the less developed regions, more in Germany than in England, and which will in the end explain the difference between pietism and evangelism, what I might call the underground reformation, the subterranean reformation. This kind of mysticism, the popular piety, which in Germany had its own saints, the great mystics of the 13th century, Meister Eckhart, a Tauler, a Zuzo, the greatest mystic of all of the 17th century, without whom pietism is unthinkable, Jakob Böhme, B-O-H-M-E. Jakob Böhme, the greatest German mystic of all. And this mystical tradition was always there to resort to. It was always there to resort to, always, against a materialistic world, against a world that was in motion. And that will never change. After all, let us remember Martin Buber wrote his doctoral thesis in 1910 on Jakob Böhme. Jakob Böhme will remain alive in Germany with its mysticism of overcoming, of contemplating God through nature, and through that contemplation having a mystical experience overcoming misery and pain, the difficulties of daily life, being able to cope, rising, as it were, above daily life. This underground revolution will have another consequence. It will fuse in the end with prophecy, with hope, because the common man had no other hope. This was his hope. This was his hope. And so it becomes what Ernst Bloch will call later the underground revolution, and which I will call the German revolution, that a revolution will come when the end comes, the last judgment, as it were, the return of Christ. But that return of Christ will come through a mystical experience, as it were, through a mystical experience, to an actualization, a making real this mystical experience. Just one more word of something later. The First League of Communists, which Marx found by Wilhelm Weitling, the First German League of Communists was based on Jakob Böhme, was in fact this underground revolution, the dawn of the apocalypse. For it is based, of course, in the end on something that is not as strong yet, but that will be stronger and stronger. The mysticism will be combined with the apocalypse, the book of the apocalypse, that the seven seals will be unsealed and the harvest will be gathered. That was always important, always important. The emancipation, the readmission of the Jews in England in the 17th century was due to the fact that Oliver Cromwell believed that that would fulfill the book of the apocalypse. The harvest would be gathered, the Jews would be converted, and therefore you had to gather them in England to convert them. The wine will be pressed, as it says in the book of the apocalypse. That in England had already happened with a civil war. So that the book of the apocalypse becomes the great revolutionary charter of this underground revolution. First war, then misery, and then the book of seals will be unlocked and the harvest will be gathered. Now, this is very important, therefore. This popular piety will never vanish. But in the 18th century, it had been deepened in Germany by another event, and that event is the 30 Years' War. The 30 Years' War, with its desolation, with its misery, with its mass death, not of war, but of disease. The 30 Years' War meant a new kind of spiritual impulse, an impulse which concentrated on Christ's suffering and death. And out of that impulse comes another figure without whom pietism could not really be go up. The first is Jakob Böhme, and the second is the greatest Christian hymnologist of modern times, apart from John Wesley, Gerhardt. Gerhardt's hymns, which are, I think you will find if you go to church, still sung today in Protestant churches. These hymns are hymns, after all, of the cross and consolation. That is, hymns of Christ's martyrdom, Christ's passion. Hymns of the cross and consolation in the face of a death and desolation which seemed inescapable. Marauding armies, a war of which the common man knew not the cause and knew not the reason, just as he knew not the cause and reason for bad harvests or the cause and reason of death and disease. So that we have it deepened in our time by the 30 Years' War, by the hymns of cross consolation, all of this outside official religion, outside dogmatism, all of this in this deep stream of popular piety, which is in Europe popular culture. Until the end of the 19th century, popular piety and popular culture are the same. The only culture we know then is this Christian popular culture. They are the same, something you must remember. To sum up, therefore, this kind of popular culture fulfilled several needs. First of all, it fulfilled the need of explanation. Explanation in an age when one lived close to nature. These people did not read Newton. They did not read Descartes. The Enlightenment was for the intellectuals. But the common man needed, and this meant the peasant in those days, needed an explanation. And second of all, it was an orientation in a world that was ever more disoriented, not only for intellectuals, but for everybody. The faster communications, the beginning of industrialization, all of these things. Young people who left their villages, a greater mobility, all of these kind of things. Greater penetration even of certain types of literature into the villages. And thirdly, it gave hope. It gave hope. The books of prophecy, the books of hope, it gave hope. It gave hope for the future. How little things change in popular culture, I want to illustrate to you one other way, by the kind of reading, popular reading. That isn't reading, really. It's being read to. There was one or two people in a village who could read, and they would read to others. In 1760 and in 1810, the most read were books of hymns. And here you can see the emotional, the song, always central in Protestant, always the most popular thing in Protestantism, the hymn. They were folk songs. Luther's hymns were based on folk songs, and many of Gerhardt's as well. The hymn and the hymn formed a community, the Protestant community. Before it became a state community, was essentially a community formed by common song. And it was so popular that by the 18th century, the hymn penetrated Catholic service. Catholic service, which had always rejected it. The Council of Trent rejects it explicitly for Gregorian chant. But by the 18th century, the hymn in Catholic service comes side to side, Granger. The second, only the second most important, is the Bible. And what comes then? Nothing but books of consolation. Books of consolation, imitations of Christ. Imitations of Christ, books of consolation of one sort or another. And finally, the calendars. The ever popular calendars, which are really books of prophecy. Books of prophecy by date. Certain prophecies for certain dates, prophecies taken from the Bible, from ancient wisdom, from one thing or another that I can't get into. But calendars, which are really as the farmer's calendar is today, books of prophecies. So that gives you an idea of the basis of this kind of pietism. The highlight of pietism is roughly between 1675 and 1730. Between 1675 and 1730, the groundstock is laid, and the groundstock is laid in Germany. John Wesley had his awakening in Zinzendorf's community. Let's forget that. English evangelism was triggered by German pietism. It went a different way. And typically enough, it went a more pragmatic way, because it didn't have that tradition of Jakob Böhme, of the mystics. This was the German tradition of the underground revolution, as Ernst Bloch will call it. There was no Wilhelm Weitling in Britain. No. In Britain, the evangelical tradition, even with Wesley, and this is why Wesley objected to pietism. This is why he left, as you will see, Zinzendorf's community called the Lord's Hat, Herrenhut, which I'll talk about in a little while. Why he left Herrenhut, partly, because it is, after all, English evangelism will be practical. German pietism will always be inward. Now, in having said that, I have said a vast and a thing so important that I cannot really stress it too much for you, for a lot of things follows from that. From that follows, first of all, German idealism, the German parish house from which so many, from Hegel to Schelling, all the romantics for German philosophers came, Nietzsche as well. The inwardness of pietism, politically and otherwise, the obedience to authority, the inwardness, the sort of underground revolution. And from that it follows eventually that English evangelism will have a second important document which you will read, Tom Brown's School Days. In a sense, you must look at your reading this way, that you're reading Zinzendorf for Germany and Tom Brown's School Days for England. For nobody would have said in German pietism what Kingsley, the English evangelist, said, that sanitary work is a religious duty. That was quite outside the German horizon. The active Christian gentleman, which you will read about in Tom Brown, becomes something very English and something very un-German. But this is because of the different ways of pietism and evangelism. To be sure, the consequence, which you will see, of modern manners and morals is the same. The consequence of respectability will be the same. But what will be totally different is the consequence which is drawn from this, the consequence which also has some roots in the sects of the English Reformation, which, of course, I cannot really mention here. Coming to evangelism itself, its founder of evangelism is Philipp Jakob Spener. And he's only the founder inasmuch as he made really obvious what was already in the air. Philipp Jakob Spener gathered around him in Frankfurt in 1670 a private group for private devotions. And these people who met at his house for Bible reading and prayer, for private devotions, were called in derision pietists, Frömmler in German, pietists. And the word pietism was at first a word of derision, which they then adopted with some pride. Spener began to systematize that, to found something that will be typical for all pietism, a group, or as we would call it, a conventicle. A conventicle, a group. A group. A group very similar to the way in which the Catholic Renaissance had been accomplished. Now, religious renaissance in the Catholicism and Protestantism after the Reformation were all accomplished that way. The official church was out, so it was accomplished by gathering private groups of prayer, laymen, not ministers, laymen, to prayer to renew religion. In Catholicism, they had a name which comes from orare, to pray. They were called oratories. And in Protestantism, in the Catholic Reformation of the 17th century, they are oratories. In the Protestant Reformation of the 18th century, they are called conventicles. But the idea behind them is the same, a spiritual renewal outside official religion, a spiritual renewal outside official religion. In 1675, Spener wrote his famous book, which is the Magna Carta, in a way, the Magna Carta of Pietism, called Pia Desideria, that is the desired piety in Latin. Pia Desideria, the desired piety, which in a way affirms this all up and is the Grand Carta. For what Spener stresses is not merely the Bible or the Lutheran Confession of Faith, the Augustana, but besides that, the new birth of the new creature, the personalization, not only of God and Christ, which seem to have gotten lost in dogma, but of yourself, the rebirth of man, the personal rebirth of man, making man, as it were, if you want, into a new a kind of creature. At the center of Pia Desideria, at the center of Spener and Pietism, stood the conversion experience. Both, by the way, internal conversion and external conversion. Internal conversion, obviously, chronicled in diaries. They got that from the Puritans. The Puritans were, of course, very influential in this. Chronicled in diaries. Diaries of your own spiritual perfection. I'll come back to that. External conversion. Spener's attempt to convert the Jews of Frankfurt, John Wesley's attempt to convert the Indians in America. Always conversion is in the center, whether it was the Jews of Frankfurt or the Indians of America. Internal conversion and external conversion are here linked. As Spener puts it, all pietism leads to the rebirth of the individual. All pietism leads to the rebirth of the individual. And indeed, they all had a conversion experience. And I must remind you that such experiences are central to Lutheran Protestantism. Luther had his great experience in the tower, as you know, of Wartburg, when he read again the famous passage of St. Paul, but you shall be saved by faith, and he added the alone in the tower. Luther's famous tower conversion experience. The second great man of pietism who institutionalized it in education, to which I shall come, Hermann Franke, had a very similar conversion experience, this time when preparing a sermon on John 20, verse 1, which is the story of resurrection and the appearance of Christ in the midst of his disciples. And he had his experience in the last verse. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name. And Franke comments, I did not believe, now I believe. So you have the sudden conversion experiences which come with reading passages of the Bible. For Luther, St. Paul, here St. John, passages of the Bible. And therefore the conversion experience is central. They try to revive it. In a way, it's reviving a spiritual religion against fossilization. Reviving the spiritual religion against fossilization is reviving the experience of personal rebirth. The experience of conversion is an experience of personal rebirth. It's a protest, a new man, not Nathan, not the new man of the Enlightenment, but reborn in Christ, personalized, not one-dimensional, but personalized. Personalized in yourself, in Christ, in both, in a way, personalized in this conversion. Inasmuch as the conversion experience is central, and of course Wesley had it too, I'll come to that, you get also by necessity the redefinition of another central Protestant tenet, the tenet of predestination. And I come here now in the next things I'm going to say to your Zinzendorf reading, yes? To your reading in Zinzendorf's 9 public lectures in religion, which you are reading. And I'm coming here to what is said about predestination in the first lecture, Euclid Lecture 1 and 6, the lecture called That the Prayer to the Father of Jesus Christ Can Be Prayed by No One But the Children of God. Now, this may mean like a very severe doctrine of election. Only the children of God may pray to God, which means, in pietistic language, only those who have had the conversion experience. That is the title of your lecture. That is the title of the lecture. And only of those who had the conversion experience. The prayer to the Father of Jesus Christ can be prayed, but no one of the children of God. And the children of God are only those who have been converted, who have had that experience of Luther in the Tower, or Franke preparing the sermon, or Spener, or John Wesley. Only those. But as you read it on, this is not at all the case. For as it is put on page 14 of your reading, therefore we can regard all sinners in an entire city, in half a world of men, as our brothers and sisters. And there's not a single soul who cannot be looked at with brotherly eyes. For even if their looks and their whole manner show that they are not people whom the Father has given to his Son, nevertheless, we are so certain that we could stake our lives on it. No human creature walks the streets. There exists no human creature, be he whoring, drinking, and living as he ever lives in all sins, who cannot, through the sovereign power of Jesus Christ, be delivered from his sins. True predestination is transposed to the fact that God, from the beginning of time, has predestined some to election and some to damnation, which is the center of the one of the centers of the Protestant creed. To that is now added that, in fact, God cannot exclude anyone. God has not excluded anyone, however evil, from that. And therefore, though election takes place, I should say, though some are the children of God and some are the children of the devil, nevertheless, at any moment, any one of the children of the devil can become the children of the Lord. Anyone can have this kind of conversion experience. For everyone is potentially saved. Everyone is potentially saved. That is the mystery of predestination. Now, notice something here. Conversion is at the center. For Calvin, it's quite different. For Calvin, God has predestined who is saved and who is damned, and you can tell already right now, by conformity to Calvinism. And you can tell right now by the way he behaves. Right now. And therefore, those who are damned have to be expelled from Geneva, some burnt at the stake. You can tell. For pietism, with its mystical component, with the component of this popular piety, And the conversion experience, predestination, is in a way changed to hope. For pietism is a doctrine of hope. So is evangelism. Hope. In Calvinism, there is very little hope, but much discipline. In evangelism, there is much hope. And discipline, as you will see, is a big problem, to which I shall return in a minute. But it is just the other way around. There is much hope, but discipline is there. Thus, anyone can really effect it. And you find it again repeated in 64, where indeed he cites the Old Testament, Isaiah, but Isaiah was a prophecy for Christ's coming, so I don't want to go into that now. But he said that God says, if they will not be acquainted with me in this way, if they are not inclined to love me in this manner, they may leave it alone. I shall force them no more. I do not want to force people. I do not want a seraglio of souls. I want free souls. I want to have bride hearts. I will voluntarily be their bridegroom. And here's something else. The conversion must be your own act. This is against the state church, against outside coercion, against the state church, obviously, against outside coercion. But it also emphasizes, in a way, the individual. It is an act of will which must stand at the beginning of conversion. God is neutral. God is neutral. He doesn't want a seraglio of souls. He wants freely chosen brides. He wants, as Zinzendorf says, freely chosen brides. Therefore, your coming of Christ must be your own act of will, an act of will of which everyone is capable, even those who drink and whore and do all of those things which Zinzendorf condemns, even to those. It is a voluntary act. It is, therefore, an act of will. And what is the center of the act of will? The center of the act of will goes back to the Puritans, goes back to mysticism, to the essence of mysticism. The center is an insight into your own illness. On page 67, in your second article, it is made clear the article is all about that. But what makes a Christian? What makes a Christian? The Savior's appearing in his suffering form before his heart. When the words which he has heard innumerable times concerning the passion of the Savior effectively constrain him either to sorrow over his sins or to misgivings. In other words, when Christ induces into you an insight into your own sins. So this is very typically mystical. It goes way back. The Puritans, of course, had it very strongly, that you're overcoming sin, in a sense, by having a consciousness of sin. And that consciousness of sin is induced by your receiving the passion of Christ. For there is always one presupposition, which becomes of vastly importance, that sin is pleasure. Sin is equated with pleasure. And Christ is equated with martyrdom and misery. Now, that's new. That comes from the 30 Years' War. Before that, you very often had a happy Christ. You will no longer have a happy Christ. Christ will now change after the 30 Years' War. And with pietism, it will change also. You no longer have the happy Christ of the 16th century, even in pictures, even in representation. It is always in any church you go to, in any church you go to. It is Christ bleeding, Christ of the Passion, always. And it is always Christ of the Passion now, because it corresponds to the problems and tribulations of an industrializing Europe, the problems and tribulations of all those changes, of living near to nature as well. It corresponds to the 30 Years' War and its aftermath of pestilence and famine. It corresponds to all of this, but it corresponds to more than this. It is also, in a way, an equation of pleasure with sin. That is, whoring and drinking is pleasure. That is presumed that this is pleasure. It's an interesting presumption. We shall come back to that. And that getting rid of it is pain and martyrdom. Getting rid of it is pain and martyrdom. And that therefore insight is necessary in order to get rid of pleasure, the rejection of the pleasure principle. But that rejection is by no means total. For the old pleasure, you get instead of pleasure, joy. Joy in being reborn, to which I'll come a little. For that joy in being reborn gives you certainty, it gives you hope, it makes what Jakob Böhme calls for overcoming. Overcoming the misery of this life, overcoming your own lower nature, or as the Puritans used to call it, the old Adam in you. Overcoming the old Adam in you and being reborn to joyfulness. But you get here an old rhythm, and a rhythm that is very ancient. The rhythm that could be illustrated from the Middle Ages on very easily. The rhythm that there has to be suffering before joy. A rhythm that is, of course, in our civilization enshrined in the story of Christ. You won't find that in other cultures. You will find that in the Christian culture. That you have to have suffering before joy. This is enshrined in the Passion of Christ. This is the story of the Passion of Christ, that there is no suffering. And in the end, of course, that becomes transposed in evangelism and in pietism, that you must have discipline before you can overcome. In other words, that what Zinzendorf writes about, this voluntarism, this soul as a bride, soon, of course, becomes transmuted into discipline, into outward signs, into good behavior, into Tom Brown's school days, into the Christian gentleman. And it becomes transmuted into something Martin Luther never knew. Luther whored, Luther drank, he drank like a fish. He heard. This is all new from pietism, this Protestantism of today. Went through pietism, something that Luther never really knew at all. The idea of building your character, that your character must be built before you can overcome, before you can convert. As it was in Rugby, the school which Tom Brown went to, as it was in my own school, as it was for all of us who went into boarding schools. Our characters were built and rebuilt until they became a shining tower. We're still waiting for the takeoff. Well, never mind. Anyway, however that is, in the end, it all came down, of course, to the rebuilding of character, to a kind of discipline, both in Germany and England. In Germany, not so much the discipline as obedience to authority. In Germany, the authority took the part of it. I'll come back to that. But in England, eventually, with John Wesley, it became a discipline. John Wesley's famous slogan, to which I shall come back, pray and save. Pray and save. So, in other words, more and more eventually, to put it briefly, in one sentence, what I shall put in more detail later. More and more, these ideas of the underground revolution became middle-class ideals, or fused with middle-class ideals. And they did so for a reason that must have been obvious for all of you while I was talking. How can you keep discipline in this theory? In this theory, everybody can go his own way. There's a wonderful dialogue between Oliver Cromwell and a radical in the English Revolution. Cromwell says, we must have this constitution. And the radical says to Oliver Cromwell, how can we have a constitution if I might get another inspiration tomorrow, which God tells me to do something quite different? And Cromwell says, well, on that basis, you cannot govern England. You can govern nothing. So this is the danger in this underground evolution, that it would escape control, that it would become chaos. The danger of an old Christian heresy, Pelagianism, to which Wesley came very close, that if you are saved, you are also free from sin. And if you are free from sin, you can do anything you like. And so already in the 17th century, where there was a heresy, you had the family of love, you had all sorts of sexual aberrations, sexual extremes, because groups of people who thought they were free of sin. And if you are saved and free of sin, you can do anything you please. Now, that had to be avoided. And in all of this Protestantism, that is the number one problem. Cromwell faced it in the English Revolution, and the Pietists faced it, and Wesley faced it. They all faced it. How do you get this under control, the people of God? How do you get the people of God under control so that being saved does not mean having license? This goes back to the origin of Christianity. This goes back to what the Pelagian heresy, to St. Augustine, wrote against it. If you write to St. Augustine, St. Augustine's tract, The City of God, was directed to this identical problem in Christian theology. If you are saved, what then about discipline? What then about community? The individuality of Christianity, the idea of salvation at the center, was always in incipient conflict with ordered society. There's no question about that. No question about that. Always incipient center. This is why this underground revolution could be a revolution in the end. This is why it could be a revolution in the end. That is why in the end, as it were, why in the end, ways of taming it had somehow and in some way had to be found, had to be found. And indeed, they were found. One way of taming, and perhaps the most important way of taming that was found, was, of course, self-discipline, consciousness of your sin, consciousness of your sin, consciousness of your sin, and consciousness of sin meant It's all very good for you to hear, you know, all of this. I'll say, and I mean it. Consciousness of sin means keeping a diary of those things in which you have fallen, as the Puritans kept their diary. But the best example comes again from England. It is from the most popular English children's book, called The Fairchild Family of 1818. And I think I shall start next time, in order to build your characters, by reading you the diary of Lucy Fairchild, age 12. And you'll be surprised. But that'll come on Wednesday.